Okay, so this is about the, that was the buildings, and this is the streets. And back to the site plan, a few basics. The river's here, and this is one of the very few North American projects where there's no pipes in the ground at all. So it's a zero pipe project. No new, read my lips, no new pipes. So the water is shedding, basically, from a bit of a small crest. When I say crest, I'm talking in the order of like 6 inches.
No supply?
From a high, huh?
No water supply? No gas supply?
No, I'm saying no, I'm sorry. Yeah, no drain pipes. No drain pipes. All right, no drain pipes. This is a bit of a small crest here. Water going this way and then around, and then other water going towards the stream. This is the highest point of the site, all that water going this way. Water is not directly run off in most cases. There's two ways of managing the water. One is to bring it into large or small receiving zones. This is the community green, which accepts all the water off the big shed-roofed building next door. And the other way is actually down through the streets. Now, some of you in this room probably know this, but others don't know this. As I alluded to before, urbanization completely destroys the hydrological function of the landscapes that it goes into. There's no question about it, unless you find a way to infiltrate water. It's real simple. It's surprising how rarely you hear it said. That's the whole game is infiltrate, infiltrate, infiltrate. And in most of North America, and it's surprising how you don't hear this much either, what you got to do is infiltrate 1 inch a day. Now, it's a little bit different in Florida. It's a little bit different in L.A., but for a lot of continental North America, 1 inch a day or 1 millimeter an hour will absorb about 90%, generally between 85% and 90%, 95% of all water that ever falls on the site. So that means that 90% of the water that goes eventually back to the stream goes through the ground first. And by going through the ground, it gets to be the right temperature, and the gradual flow of that water to the stream both ensures that the rate of flow in the stream is consistent and that when the water gets there, it will be clean. Dirt, especially clay, by the way, the heavier the dirt, the better it cleans. But dirt is the best way to clean water. So this diagram shows you this is the way the green infrastructure condition is working. Runoff only accounts for 10%. That's the design, by the way. You'll see later that the project actually has a runoff rate of zero, which is better. But your target should be 10% is allowed for you to run off. That means your big storms in excess of 1 inch, are allowed to run off into the stream, more or less directly. But that's okay, because 90% of the time, the small storms are going into the ground. Does that make sense? All right. Yeah.
How's nature as is?
Nature is, in this, it depends on what landscape you're in, and if you're in Tucson, a lot of it's running off because they have that wash kind of thing going on. But in the Cascadia area, Oregon, Washington, and Vancouver, in forested landscapes, effectively 100% of all water that falls on the site is going through the ground or up through evapotranspiration. The figures in Washington State coastal forest are 30%, 35% evapotranspiration over the course of the year, and the rest is through the ground. None of it overland flow, zero. You will, of course, get bizarre conditions like after the snow's there and it sort of melts and then it freezes over. So there might be this one day where you get sheet ice on a natural landscape where it will run off. But effectively, the answer to your question is zero runs off. And that's, again, unfortunately, this is what we generally do. We completely destroy that system when we urbanize, even suburban landscapes are because they are hydrologically connected, roof, downspout, driveway, street to the stream, immediately after the storm you get 75% of all water on the site goes as runoff. But the problem is, because all that runoff gets to the stream in the first hour rather than in the first month after the storm, you can get velocities and volumes of like 100 times greater in the stream after urbanization, which completely destroys them. The destruction of the streams in this landscape and most other parts of North America is not a consequence of pollution. It's much more a consequence of the radically increased velocities in the streams post-urbanization, which destroy the stream profile that has taken 10,000 years to be formed since the last glacier left. Okay, so take-home message, infiltrate, 1 inch a day, 90%. You do that, you're mostly cool, and it's not that hard, really. So it gets harder when you actually try to do this, though, and the hardest part is getting people to believe it's even possible. So, and we'll go into some of the reasons why that is, but at the end of a long process of exploration on the site, this is the street section that was eventually chosen. It's not the only way to do this kind of infiltration, but this is the one that was chosen here. And what it is a street of conventional asphalt, but one that has pervious pores through it. And to do that, it's not technically difficult. You simply remove the small fines from the asphalt mix, which means that when it's set out there in place, it's honeycombed and has a lot of voids which allow water to go down through it. That's at the top. Down below that is this immense pad of crushed stone, which both provides support for the bearing surface as well as reservoir space such that when it rains, the water has some place to go once it goes through the pavement. A lot of people make the mistake of thinking all you have to do is get pervious pavement. You need both pervious pavement and reservoir space. Reservoir amounts changing based on how aggressively the subsoils can accept the water that you've stored. There's some technical issues there, but that's the sum and substance of it. In the Pringle Creek project, there was 10 inches. Basically, there's an 18-inch immense pad of crushed stone. The dimensions of this crushed stone go beyond what is necessary for either reservoir space or conventional sense in that landscape of what's required for structural stability. The additional 6 inches, which was added beyond the original proposed 12, was added because there was concern about the fact that this the soil under here, which is not shown in the section, needs to not be compacted. Because if you compact it, it obviously interferes with the capacity of those soils to accept water and let that water through. So given that it's uncompacted soil, it's not as dependable structurally in the parlance of the engineering community, and therefore may be more subject, consequently, to heaving. A side question I'd like to talk about with this group later on, by the way, is why we insist on having roads in very lightly traveled residential landscapes like this one engineered in a way that's going to last 100 years, which under present circumstances is probably longer than Greenland is going to last, you know, fully covered with ice. And, you know, it's one of these oddities that on the one hand we have this sense of things needing in the engineered landscape to last forever, but the consequences, at least indirectly, of that attitude is that we're accelerating our headlong rush towards environmental Armageddon. I don't exaggerate at all. Very carefully. The excavation... you allow the machines on to excavate it. We don't actually have a good shot of the excavation, but you allow the machines on to excavate. You try to keep the machines off of that until you can spread the basalt on. When the basalt is on, that provides enough distribution of loads so that you can drive on the basalt and then later the base course without Without compacting that soil. That's about right, yeah?
Yeah. Well, they do different things where when they're dumping their load, they back over it. I mean, they don't, the typical where you're driving down the dirt with it coming out behind, they reverse some processes to just ensure that there's been protection prior to actually loading it up very heavily.
Now, this is a picture of the basalt. Poor Don was... one of the worst days of his life was when the trucks came in with, what was it, 400,000 cubic yards of basalt. I said, I exaggerate a little bit, but it was an immense mountain of this stuff. Fortunately, from local sources, so it wasn't trucked too far. And this is the basalt in place before it was covered with the base coat of asphalt. Here you see them laying. You can see... the material there, particular attention to the material on the left. It looks like ordinary asphalt, except it looks like looks like the roughest course. So the appearance of this is in every way like ordinary asphalt, except that it looks rougher. It meets ADA, Americans with Disability Act requirements, because it is, in fact, smooth for walking. It just looks rougher. And here is a view of the site, which starts to show you what happens with these roads in place. I think I have a somewhat better slide of the edge condition of these. Another slide that's showing you it looks kind of strange.
Sure, it's funny there.
Yeah, there's a funny deal going on. But nevertheless, this shows you the base. This shows you the basalt structural base waiting for the asphalt to be laid, the filter fabric on the edge, which prevents the migration of this soil on the side of the road cut section from migrating into the the structural base. The biggest issue here in terms of engineering problems is not that it fails in the ways that people conventionally imagine, like freeze-thaw problems and so forth. Actually, getting full of dirt is the only real problem for this kind of material. So incredible care must be exercised to make sure that this, particularly this, the surface and the structural base, do not get filled with dirt, because their function will be entirely compromised if that were to happen. To the point where the kind of care that was required in this project was extreme, the horizontal contractors who did all the roads decided that it was cheaper for them and easier for them to keep this system clean during the dirty part of the construction, as you can see going on in the back, by literally wrapping the whole street system in filter fabric. So they drove on this filter fabric for, 6 months, 8 months, that kind of thing, while the site was very dirty, as a precaution about getting the base course and the substructural layer full of dirt, and thus compromised its activity. This raises the question of the cost of this system, and I keep trying to get absolute clarity on this because everybody wants to know, but based on what we can figure out so far, the cost of doing this is about the same in the Pringle Creek example that as would be the cost of a curb and gutter system with drain inlets. What you save on not having curbs and gutters and drains and access basins and all that stuff, you partly or maybe completely lose because of the care required. But the point here is that this system is not more expensive to install, at least in the experience of Pringle Creek, than the alternative system. Here's a close-up. You can get a sense of scale from the feet, and this is a U.S. quarter. It's presently worth about 22 cents Canadian.
It's smaller than it used to be.
Much, lot smaller than it used to be. And the filter fabric on top. A closer up of this, my favorite photograph.
There's a lot of young kids that are going to scrape themselves bad on that road. How do you guys feel about that?
I think there's concern about that, but my feeling is that the worst cuts I ever got were on slightly weathered concrete. I would probably argue, although I haven't seen research, that ordinary concrete sidewalks are more abrasive than is this material.
Well, have there been rollerbladers on the street?
You jump from a rollerblading side, it's just fine. There's no real difference that you feel under the wheels.
This aggregate, this is the bottom lip of the street, and it's inch and a half aggregate, and the top lip is about 5/8 aggregate. It's actually a lot finer than the top coat that it's showing.
I was just kidding.
Oh, yeah, sure.
These kids are going to be tough.
They're going to be tough.
So this is the installed, basically the installed streets. This is a condition. You see it if you go down there now, and the millions of tour buses that tour the to the area every week. If we could charge these people a buck a head, we'd be in really good shape. Obviously, utility infrastructure shown by the access basin. No pipes again, so any time you get the Noah's flood storm that can't be absorbed by the street directly, it would be sent to this edge here where there's one last opportunity for it to go down into the ground in this stone swale. But should it be delivered, it's conveyed horizontally first to rain gardens at the end of every intersection, and then and only then allowed to escape back into the stream. So there's a whole series of cascading, mitigating features of this landscape, more really than so far have been needed, because there were 2 100-year storms within a month or so. And in both cases, even though the design target was for 1 inch, the storms were over 4 inches, and they came in relatively rapid succession. And we observed no conveyance flow at all on the site. So everything was going down into the soil and then being delivered through the soil to the stream as what's called interflow. So our favorite photograph is this one. What you're looking at is the conventional street, which is Strong Road, which is the access arterial at the edge of the project, and then the site streets. So this is a heavy storm, and it allows you to see the kind of sheet flow that is we take for granted as a part of a conventional circumstance of urban living, but doesn't have to be that way. It can be like this, and a very dramatic demonstration of the capacity to superimpose urbanization on a landscape in a way that the fish don't even know you're there. Right? This is effectively, from the perspective of fish habitat, and an invisible imposition on the landscape. It just doesn't influence them at all. And in fact, it probably makes it somewhat better than it was before we started. Thanks.
I think what's interesting about this, too, is that you watch the water, and it just it's flowing off the impervious asphalt, and it just slowly disappears as it sort of moves. And depending on how much rain is coming down, it may go in 6 inches, 2 inches. It may take a foot before it slowly disappears as it's moving. It's sheeting this way across the area. The house plan generally, and Don keeps reminding us, he's got escrow papers if anybody is interested too. Part of it is selling as we move around here. But you can see the final residential lot outline that was created, and this goes with a whole series of documents related to housing types that can be put on the site. We started with what we call a cottage home or a discovery house. We wanted to sort of use it as a starting point for everybody to understand sort of what our goals were. One of the ideas, too, is this is a commercial project. I mean, this project is intended to establish principles. It's intended to make money. It's intended to sort of be a living laboratory for others. This discovery house, we worked very directly with the builders. We've come up with a whole set of criteria relating to construction methodologies. We determined reasonably early that we would use LEED H as a system for the entire site with all of the residential. We took LEED Silver as a baseline that is in the design guidelines. The first house, however, we wanted to raise the bar, so LEED Platinum. This house was awarded sort of the highest at the time. It was certified the highest rated LEED Platinum in the United States. We worked with the Department of Energy for some of our analysis on wall types. We really looked through many systems in terms of how do they really perform. We had builders that then analyzed these wall types relative to material use and relative to cost. The walls that surprisingly were fairly high performance, at that time we were looking at Duracell block, an ICF system that we were considering. The price of that pushed us out of our range. What we ended up considering then was two more standard wood frame systems. We negotiated a contract with a family-owned lumber mill for FSC lumber. So we also, going back to some of those original principles, allowed us to sort of consider that that was an important part of what Pringle Creek would all would be about. We also analyzed the number of systems in terms of energy efficiency. The one nice thing about when you go get a platinum is you don't have very many decisions to make because you basically have to go for every single point that's there. So in some ways, it's a straightaway to get to the get to the end. Let's see what we got here. Working with the builders is the biggest, and I think that showed up in a couple sessions, is really not only the builders, but you have to actually get down to the subcontractor level and be sure that they're understanding, they've been educated, they've bought on, and that in essence you have to sort of break them away from what they were doing just down the street within a more typical subdivision into what Pringle Creek is all about. When we set up to build this house, we also wanted to take away some of the boogeymen about what that was all about. So we established in the end of January, we put it on the tour of homes, which was in June. So we did the push out the beginning of February, and it was done and ready for the tour of homes in June. So again, it showed that even with sort of LEED certification and green building components, you can still operate at a production level relative to delivering a house. We looked at the footprint. We looked at thermal performance. We looked at making sure that the indoor air quality was, as we sealed the house, was appropriate. You can see that one of the key components was a rain screen system. So in essence, we had a typical high-performance framing system, but we wrapped it with one inch of insulation, wrapped it with housing wrap, and then you can begin to see the battens that are happening here. So then we floated a rain screen system off the front of that. And actually in BC, they've been doing it for longer in terms of rain screens, but this belief that the durability is really as important as anything, and if we can't rely on caulk to seal, so the house very much was understanding that, and those conditions were brought into the cottage very early on. I think we like the fact, yes? You know, I can't even remember our final R value. Let me see if it was in this thing.
Remember how much insulation it was?
I think we ended up with about R 24, 25. We did one inch of rigid and 6 inches or a 6-inch wall of blow-in cellulose. So those are the two components and then a full wrap.
And those are Durasol stem walls?
We ended up, what also was interesting, you notice there's no vents. We ended up pouring a concrete wall. A lot of that was just coordination, and we, once there wasn't a lot of Durasol, it didn't make sense to just try to ship in a small amount. There's actually now about 40 miles away a plant that is making a product just like this that we're using. We, quite honestly, had a little bit of a hard time trucking that product at that weight across the country. So as we were evaluating our points, that always came up relative to really a systems evaluation. But we have an unvented crawl space is another. When we were running all of our energy conditions, we ended up with a heat recovery unit, an unvented space as a way to sort of maximize our performance. Presently, we are monitoring the house. We're working with the Oregon Department of Energy for water and energy use, just to really begin to see how the house is performing and verify. It was exciting. I can tell you that during the tour of homes, the meter actually ran backwards. So we made more energy during the tour of homes than we actually used. So that was it's hard to believe one could get excited about a meter running backwards, but that was very nice to see. You can see the completed house, south-facing. We have both PVs and hot water that was on the house. A lot of the materials were placed in a way so that this people could understand also when we're going to all of these, as Ron described, these housing types, we wanted a tire to kick also so that they were sort of understanding what does it mean to be in a green home, because we were talking about people that really didn't know what it would be. I mean, they could imagine it. They've heard it. In a lot of ways, they think it has less quality because they think lots of stuff has been recycled. So the education to the market was important as anything for us relative to people understanding and being willing to step up and sort of pay the money, so to speak. We have opponents like, you know, extensive daylighting. I think when you walk into this house, people aren't sure why it feels good to them, but they know it feels good. So when you start walking through in the windows, the locations, the fact that light comes in from all four sides, it's not singular, and the ceilings are higher, the air moves differently, those begin to do an indoor air quality and kind of sort of psychological conditions, I think, that are fairly important. You can see the full height that we have. This is a 1,400 square foot cottage, highly sustainable. This is a Pacific Madrone flora that's harvested in the Coast Range, so we did that in terms of local local conditions. Again, a lot of the things we were looking for is to make sure that design quality was part of the sustainability of the house, that we could have the performance, and with all of the performance, we didn't compromise anything related to the house. This is on the geothermal system also, so this has a as part of the geothermal system, and we think about layering our geothermal system, which is a ground source heat system, about 80 houses, is also is the irrigation system. So we have a well that's 400 gallons per minute, open well. So during the summer months, you actually take the water after it's been used for heating or cooling, and that can be used in irrigation and or into the injection well. It has both options in terms of how it would go. The last one is a house that's under construction right now, which is we're calling the tall house or tree house, three-story house. It's right now scheduled for LEED Gold. This was a homeowners that came in, and it was more about the community as they began. We began to work with them as a custom home. They became more appreciative. So all of the same components that were in the Discovery Cottage then became an understanding for them, so we could have a language and a discussion with them because it related right back to an existing house that was on the site. So that very much helped us, and we were able to incorporate many of the same components in terms of daylighting, where sun shades were located, how you block summer heat, how you capture winter heat. We really developed the rain screen. We did mock-ups on site so people could understand the rain screen. We still think we have more education to do regarding infrared scanning, so again, someone can understand the difference between this wall system and what's a typical spec house that may be down the street. Again, all FSC wood that was used on it. After that, what we try to do is have a lot of the things which just looked fairly typical. I mean, there really isn't anything overtly special about wood framing high performance. You line up studs, you line up joists, you do different components on that. We actually dimensioned the house in ways to minimize the framing, so that we were looking at sheets of plywood and just trying to be fairly rigorous and logical about how those were applied. We worked with the builder to actually give them, on our drawings, a framing layout so that they could do takeoffs in a simpler manner. To make it as friendly as possible was really what the goal was. You can see the house as it moves along through its construction. So this is the status of the construction in this house just as recently as a couple weeks ago. And then a comment along this is that what I think became very interesting for me is that and Don will talk about it here a little bit in terms of closing us, but is the sense of community and how the built environment and all of the green features and all that component. But what has continued to surprise me and be very interesting is the fact that how much about people that are attracted to Pringle Creek, it's about the place as a whole, about how it feels, it's about the sense of community, it's about the relationship to open space. It's about the fact that there's some heritage, that there are existing components that have left, that it's not a site that was scraped and, in essence, brand new and recreated. There's a 1,600-year-old yew tree that's on site, as an example, or there's some of these buildings, basically none of the buildings are overly historic, but they do have a character that helps in terms of the character of the space. Well, we have heat recovery units. So we have heat recovery units, and those are tied to CO2 sensors, actually. And one of the ways it's tied to the CO2 sensors is that if you're not there for a week, you don't have the air moving. And so we wanted a system that could be variable and tied into getting out the moisture that's in the bathrooms and just and a fresh air system in terms of what it is. So we have a central heat recovery unit.
If you do load our test and make your builder follow up in this group and describe,
well, and that's one advantage of LEED is it's third-party commissioning. I can't remember the exact rates, but it was, somebody here would know the numbers. It was three times better, you know, whatever, 8.5 or so. I think the code says 2 and we were at 8.5 or something like that. So the, so when you do the blow-in cellulose and then isonine rafters and then you do rigid and then you do a building wrap, it was really sealed. The key was the heat recovery unit because so we could be sure that there was fresh air in it. And that was the magic of it because you're well sealed and you end up with the heat recovery unit actually being assured that there's fresh air because it's CO2-based. It won't run then. Yeah.
That's kind of
yeah.
And then did you get a really efficient one in the small size at
that? Yeah, I don't know the exact efficiency. We got it as small as we could. One of the other things, even though it's a small cottage, is all the mechanical stuff is inside the envelope, the insulated envelope. So we've got some hips where we have the furnaces and the heat recovery units and that type of thing.
Great. Here's a photo of one of our volunteers from the garden last year growing food. Some of the volunteers take the food home, and then we donate the rest of the proceeds to the local food bank. Back to some of those original concepts that we talked about, to building a sustainable green community, I just bullet pointed a few of the things that you heard. On the green infrastructure side, Patrick did a really nice job, you know, describing our streets. The porous street system with the porous concrete and the porous pavement, it's the largest community porous street system in North America. You know, 90% to 100% of the stormwater goes back into the aquifer, which is a big deal. And when working with Oregon Water Resources Department and some of our consultants, I learned a new saying. They said, whiskey's for drinking and water's for fighting. You know, and water's a big deal. Water's the new oil. So to take all this water that falls on our site, manage it properly through this layered street system that you walk on, you drive your car on, you park your car, but in reality it's a stormwater system, and you're putting all that water back into the aquifer. We're using basically the same aquifer to pump the water out for all of our on-site irrigation needs instead of using expensive chlorinated potable drinking water, and we also use the same water again to use in our geothermal system. So it's a very, very nice, compelling use of a natural resource. The LEED Platinum is great. James put us on the track of the United States Green Building Council LEED program, and after studying other programs, I'm just thrilled that we did it. When we work with consumers, they understand it, they like it. At first, all they think about is the $3,500 that's going to be added to their budget for all of those third-party tests. But at the end of the day, James can tell them that it's a great building. As a developer, I can tell them it's a wonderful building, our contractors can tell them it's a great building. But having somebody from Earth Advantage through PGE come down and do all these blower tests with the scientific paperwork right there, they love it, and they get real competitive. First, it's like, oh, I have to adhere to LEED Silver. Then it's like, well, what do I need to do to get the LEED Gold? And it's a really interesting process. So it helps with the education and the ongoing durability of the home. And we don't use green hardly at all when we describe our housing types. We talk about durability, indoor air quality, preventing mold, using alternative energy, saving money, the economics of having a really well-built, tight home. And the consumers are really starting to glom on to that. Yeah, it's healthy. It's just a healthy, nice place to live. And to help us understand it more, we moved my offices in that cottage home now, which is a great place. I love it. I mean, it's a fantastic place to have to work. There's light everywhere. It's light and bright. It's a fantastic place to be. So I could imagine living in a home like that would be fabulous. Also, all of our commercial buildings, we're going to build them to LEED Platinum standards, and we're going to start a regeneration of the Painter's Building here in a couple of weeks. And it's not that hard because we've done all of the site portions for LEED, and it's just really dialing in the construction. Our Sustainable Living Center with the education, the geothermal, and then working with the Oregon Department of Energy, they've studied all of our sites. And it's kind of a quandary. When you save the trees, it screws up some of the lots for solar access. So there's kind of a little bit of trade-off. And we know that about 80% of our lots will have very active solar opportunities. We also have As part of our Sustainable Living Center, we have a flower power biodiesel co-op. We run a little nonprofit biodiesel co-op. We have about 80 members that come in. We sell the biodiesel at cost. It's kind of a groovy, fun thing, and it brings a different element into Pringle Creek, and it's a fun thing to do. Here's one of the greenhouses. We have two of them. They're 129 feet long and 29 feet wide, and they're fantastic. And as soon as it warms up, the putty and the glass is going in. We can't wait. But, you know, most developers would have taken these two greenhouses, knocked them down. You know, you can do the math real quick in your head, six lots at 125 a lot. Or do you save these greenhouses and have this, you know, community amenity really doesn't do the greenhouses justice. It's the threshold when you're driving into the village center. And when you're shrinking down lots and people don't have the extra yard, this is a perfect place for them to participate, to get to make new friends and to grow plants and flowers. We're going to have some commercial application for these greenhouses, too. We'll grow some of the plant material for our green roofs for our community buildings, such as garages and our geothermal house and stuff. We'll grow the plant material in here. On the left, I think that's some University of Oregon students there contemplating. James gives them this similar presentation, and it's just so much fun to watch the lights go on. And then when we go back to their design studio, and then they present all of the different concepts and ideas on how they would develop the commercial properties, different ideas on residential construction, it's amazing. And it's one of the funnest days of the year for me is when James and I go down to U of O and listen to somebody explain our project back to us. It's fantastic. On the right, these aspen trees, you know, we spend a lot of money on landscaping, but that natural environment is so important to us. Those aspen trees wholesale were $15,000, but I didn't want to put some little sticks in there, so we spent a little bit of extra money and put these aspens in. And this is crushed stone granite that all of the rooftops in the commercial area drain into. Some more students studying the creek, the riparian zone, they're sketching, and then learning about the cottage home. This is Murph Day last year, this young lady, defining stewardship through culture, community, and helping citizens through education. We gave you kind of the quick glossy, and I do have earnest money agreements for everybody, so before you leave, I'll be at the back of the room. But we gave you the quick glossy and stuff, but we want to be challenged a little bit and talk about kind of some of the challenges, the hurdles, the down and dirty, some, you know, tough questions that you might have with projects that you have, because Pringle really does incorporate a lot of the different ideas and up-to-date different opportunities in sustainable development. So we're happy to answer the hard questions that you might have on our project. If you have hard, you know, questions on the development side, the guy that's on the ground every day wrestling with the contractors and taking these guys' vision and making it real, we're more than happy. The doors are closed here, so I think we're taping this, but so we'll keep it civil, but we will answer your questions.